Good afternoon and welcome to Veterans Radio. My name is Dale Thronberry and I get to be your host today on a special program. As many of you know, Lieutenant Colonel Charles Kettles, Medal of Honor recipient, passed away on Monday, January 21st of 2019. Colonel Kettles had been a frequent guest on Veterans Radio, and we just felt that it was our duty and our honor to replay a couple of his interviews. The first one you'll hear is from November of 2015, shortly after Colonel Kettles learned that his Distinguished Service Cross was going to be upgraded to the Medal of Honor. The second half of today's program is from August 28th of 2016, after he did receive his Medal of Honor from President Barack Obama. In that interview, we will also hear from Colonel Donald Long, who took part in the same mission with Colonel Kettles and was shot down. I want to remind our audience that Veterans Radio is sponsored by Legal Help for Veterans, U.S. Wings, American Legion Post 46, VFW Post 423, and the Charles S. Kettles Post 310 of the Vietnam Veterans of America. We hope that you will sit back and enjoy these two interviews with what we feel is a true American hero, Lieutenant Colonel Charles S. Kettles, Medal of Honor recipient.
All across America and around the world, this is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
And now, your host for today's program, Dale Thronberry.
And good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Veterans Radio. It is my privilege and honor to be talking to you this Sunday afternoon in a beautiful Michigan. We're very happy with our weather finally. Well, we're very privileged today to have joining us in the studios is one of the newest, I guess you could say, recipients of a Medal of Honor. It's not quite official yet, but we're working on it. And we're going to talk about that story in a moment with Colonel Chuck Kettles, who is going to be hopefully receiving his Medal of Honor in a short period of time. And he's a fellow helicopter pilot. So after we take this break, you're going to hear a little segment that talks about helicopter pilots, and then we'll get into our interview. We'll be right back after this.
He blesses the boys as they stand in line. The smell of gun grease and their bayonets, they shine. He's there to help them all that he can. To make them feel wanted, he's a good holy man.
We are back on Veterans Radio talking to a fellow sky pilot sitting across the table from me right now, and that is retired United States Army Colonel Charles Chuck Kettles. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good afternoon, whatever time it is. I get so flustered when things don't necessarily go the way that I want them to. But, Chuck, I want to welcome you to Veterans Radio.
Well, thank you.
Also joining me in the studio right now is Bill Volano. Bill, welcome back to Veterans Radio.
Thank you.
And, Bill, you got involved in this whole project. Can you tell me how you got involved in this whole project?
Well, I'm the coordinator of the Veterans History Project for the Ypsilanti Rotary Club, and I had the honor of interviewing Chuck probably 5 years ago, whatever.
Well, closer to 10 or 12.
10 or 12, oh, okay. Wow, how time goes. And I was impressed with his story, and from there I went to one of the people that he talked about, Ron Schreck, mm-hmm. who lived in Maryland. And from there, it just kept snowballing and finding out a whole bunch of things. And then I decided that his award was downgraded when he was in Vietnam. And I thought that there ought to be something to upgrade it.
Mm-hmm.
Also, I'm a David Letterman fan, so I don't know how many times I've seen him honor Medal of Honor winners. And taking nothing away from them, I compare what they were awarded their medal for and what Chuck did, and it seemed to me that they were kind of in a picnic by comparison.
Well, it's let's talk about that a little bit, Chuck. You're back in 1967,
66? It's 15 May, 67, yes.
Okay, so on the 15th of May, 1967, I was just beginning basic training at that time. So tell us a little bit about that day.
Well, it started out fairly early in the morning with what may have been regarded as a routine mission, where we inserted through two flights with eight helicopters. A total of 80 troops were inserted in a landing zone on one side of a hill mass. The troops moved around the base of that hill mass and into a valley with a dry riverbed and were ambushed. So probably 2 hours into that project, they called for reinforcements and to remove the wounded that were there. So we, again, with eight helicopters, went back in with another 80 troops and pulled out the wounded. And then that deteriorated further over the course of the day. So late in the day, when sun was beginning to set, they called for emergency extraction of the remaining 44 troops that were there. Four of those were crew members that belonged to my platoon, and they had taken the motor round on the mast of the helicopter, and it burned in the LZ. And the LZ, the landing zone that is, was such that we went in there in a trail formation. And I was lead, of course. And when the trail aircraft commander called and said all troops were on board, I lifted out of there with the entire six aircraft. Five of those had been borrowed from a sister company, the 161st Assault Helicopter Company, because we in the 176th had only one flyable, which was the one I had.
You broke them. Somebody broke them.
Well,
somebody threw stuff at them, I think.
Well,
really what
yes,
happened.
Charlie was about as ambitious as we were, mm-hmm. and had successfully peppered our aircraft to where we were down to one when they called for their emergency extraction. So therefore, we had to contact the 161st through the battalion and get their support. They came with crews, of course, and we rendezvoused in the area and went in to pick up the 44. When we departed that LZ at about 1,500 feet and headed back toward the base, which was at Dutfo, and the medevac med system was back there, the command and control aircraft, I'm not sure who went on board that, whether it was the battalion commander or brigade commander, informed me that there were eight troops that didn't get on board the helicopters. And it had been pretty chaotic, so not surprising, but these eight had been down in the riverbed doing the last defensive positions to as the helicopters were loaded. I had on my helicopter only one of the ground troops. But anyway, I had no idea where the rest of them were, but eight of them were on the ground yet.
This is and you're flying in a D model. I'm just to talk to our audience. You're flying in a D model Huey at this time.
Correct? That's correct.
Right. And that didn't quite have as much power as the H model that I was fortunate to fly. And you were up in the Highlands.
And that's correct.
So it was a little difficult to get off the ground sometimes.
They were in underpowered by comparison with the H model. Mm-hmm. You had the Dash 11 engine and the in the D model and dash 13 engine in the H model. So anyway, at about 1,500 feet, and I had only one grunt on board, plus the crew, of course, I told number two to take over the lead and take them back to the hostile pad or duckfold strip as appropriate. And by then, of course, the gunships had departed the area. The Air Force had departed, and the artillery had shut down because the LZ was clear as far as they were concerned. But anyway, we still had eight troops on the ground that certainly wanted to get out of there. So I broke off, and they were to the left of me, and I was in the left seat. I took control from the co-pilot. I say co-pilot, he was the unit flight standardization instructor pilot, so certainly well qualified, and he flew much of the mission since I had the three radios to deal with and the rest of the business. Anyway, it broke off, and I took control of it because I could see the troops, and put it into a sharp left turn into the LZ again. And as we approached the touchdown point, shortly thereafter, while a mortar round went off just off the nose and took out the chin bubble and part of the left and right windshield. And I later learned that some of the shrapnel went into the back and hit some of those the troops who had been on board. My co-pilot, Ray Sechrist, when I was satisfied that we had all eight, took over the controls and began to depart. The D model violently fishtailed, and I wasn't sure why, but anyway, I simply assumed the controls at that point. I wasn't sure whether his anti-torque controls had been lost, and I later learned that while the helicopter tended to fishtail rather violently, one of the ground troops got thrown out of the left side and caught the skid as he was going out, and his buddies brought him back in. So it was not exactly your storybook departure.
Not your textbook takeoff.
No. And the helicopter being overloaded, the engine couldn't maintain RPM on the rotor blades that would give us a normal departure. And the terrain was such that you couldn't make what we would call a normal running takeoff.
Right.
So as the rotor RPM would dissipate, we'd trade that altitude, what was a couple of feet, for rotor RPM. Then when the rotor RPM would get back up to a normal, we'd then lift again, and what we're looking for is translational lift.
Right.
Where
the aircraft actually gets a good bite of the air and takes off.
Yeah, because the air is dirty in a hover because it's rolling up over the blades. And simply trading altitude, a few feet, for rotor RPM, then rotor RPM for forward speed because we need about 40 knots. And it was way over gross, and I knew that. And it flew like a 2.5-ton truck. And so after bouncing off the riverbed, which was not smooth, and doing that about 5 or 6 times, then it finally got into translational lift. If it was going to go at all, it would go then, and it did. Now, not a real steep departure, but we didn't need it. All we needed to do was get the hell out of there.
That's the name of that. This is sort of like the way Charlie's describing it. It's kind of leapfrogging, bouncing, bouncing down this stream bed before he actually hit enough airspeed and altitude to take off. And, You didn't have to go high. You probably just went to the top of the trees and just went like a bat.
Well, it was just down the valley, and finally we got enough altitude to go back to base. But
That's quite the story.
After he described this to me, I was, of course, in awe, and all he had to say was, piece of cake.
You know, we're laughing about this, and I've never been in a situation as bad as that. But one of the things that I noticed that really caught my attention in the article that was in M Live talking about the upgrading of your award, and of course I left that in the other room, but it's that you can't leave them behind.
No, we're not going to leave them behind.
No, we could never leave them behind, and whether we had 10 people on board the aircraft, and there was only room, you know, there was one guy still in the LV, somebody would go back and get him. And whether the guns were gone, as you mentioned, because they ran out of ammunition, they ran out of fuel, they got, sent off to another mission, and that was just what we were taught. And I am in awe of you for your skills. And also, I don't know if people can, it's too bad it's not television, because I don't know if you can see my eyes going up and down and kind of getting a little excited here, because I can relate to many of the things that you were talking about. And so, as a result of this, you were awarded, and I have to correct Bill here, you never win an award, you're always you're a recipient, that you received the Distinguished Service Cross, which is number 2 on the list as far as awards for valor. How did you feel about, did you think about that at all, or did you just go out the next day and do the next mission?
No, I mean, that mission, as far as I was concerned, was finished and satisfactory, and those 44 names don't appear on the wall in Washington, and that in itself was gratification enough. On to whatever next. Now, the company commander said that evening, invited me to go have dinner with him, which was normal enough. And I figured he had something more on his mind than just dinner. But he said, Chuck, I'm going to move you in to be the operations officer. And I said, why is that? Because I'm quite happy where I am. He said, well, I figured maybe you could figure out what an assault helicopter company does without any helicopters. So I became the operations officer, which was not my cup of tea.
I would think not.
But anyway, it wasn't long after that, and the brigade needed a replacement for their brigade aviation officer. So again, I have dinner. I hesitated to have dinner with the company commander anymore.
I understand that.
But he said, you're going to be transferred up to be the brigade aviation officer. And I said, why is that? He said, well, because they've lost their brigade aviation officer and you're going to be the replacement. And I said, do I have anything to say about that? I'd just soon stay down here. He said, no, you don't. The general says that you're to be the brigade aviation officer. So
that was,
then I got...
You know, it's like taking a champion out of the ring and putting somebody else in it.
Well,
the way it sounds to me.
I mean, I was quite happy being the platoon commander with 8 slicks and the crews. And that was more my forte than being up in the brigade and that level.
And plus, you get to fly.
Well, they gave me an H-23 to fly.
That's what I learned how to fly in.
That's what I learned to fly, too.
Holy smokes. That thing goes a whole, 50 miles an hour, maybe?
Well,
and if you get out and run next to it,
that's only part of it. I mean, you're
no
out
armament.
There, you're out there by yourself with a carbine and a sidearm, and
I'm going to have to find a picture. I have a picture of the OH-23 at home. I wish I'd known we were going to talk about this. People would not believe what this thing looks like. It's a bubble with a stick out the back, and that's about it.
Well, it's about the same as the H-13, which was
true.
Probably most people are familiar with from MASH and that sort
that's
of thing.
That's true. So you did two tours in Vietnam, and we're running out of time. I'm gonna keep you after the news if you don't mind.
Okay.
Do you mind? Can you guys do that? I'm gonna keep Chuck after the news. So if you could ask our next guest to just be patient, we'll bring her on shortly. But I want him to hear that thing also. All right. So when did you join the service originally?
Well, I was originally drafted for the Korean War in '51.
And how did you get into aviation?
Well, went through OCS, and then they found that they were interested in pilots, so I went through flight training. But by the time I got to Korea, the war had been over about 5 months.
Right.
So I spent about 6 months in Korea, and then the entire artillery group moved to Japan.
Oh, okay.
And from there, I went to Thailand. And
oh, you got to go all kinds of places.
Yeah. Well, I joined the 32nd Engineer Topo Unit, which was making maps of Thailand and so on at that point. Okay. So
we need to take a break, and when we come back, I want to talk a little bit with more Chuck and with Bill about this upgrade of his award to the Medal of Honor. I mean, I could sit here and talk with you for hours about helicopters. This stuff is fascinating to me. I'm sorry we don't have more time. We're going to get you back on and do this again. Bill Villano, thank you so much for the work that you did to get his award upgraded to the Congressional Medal of Honor, which is the highest thing in the world.
There were at least a half a dozen or more people who served with Chuck that submitted testimony to Congressman Dingell's office. And, I'm not modest about that, but really there's a lot of other people that deserve credit.
Well, there's a lot of people that served in Vietnam that some of them didn't get the credit that they deserve. And I know that you and I probably both feel the same way, that we were honored to serve. And we were honored to know these men and women that we had the opportunity to meet when we were there.
It was certainly an opportunity to serve. And the military had spent a great deal in training, just nothing more than myself. And nice to have an opportunity to pay back.
It is a good payback. And you represent all the things that are the best of America's military, so I want to thank you, and I salute you, sir.
Thank you.
And we will see you again on Veterans Radio. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
It was just another day in the life of a soldier, this meek and humble man, with his weight on his shoulder. When generals heard the news, there were 44 soldiers pinned down. He went back once more. He didn't hesitate. Not a minute we can't wait. There are soldiers out there somewhere in the jungles of Vietnam. There's a mother somewhere back at home waiting to hear from a daughter or son. We gotta get those soldiers out. They gotta know we tried. We can't leave them there to die. We got to try. Now the sun has gone down on a day I won't forget, when three times before we flew in this hornet's nest. I've never seen the sky on fire like this before, and I've never been this close knocking on heaven's door. But there's still a more soldiers on the ground. somewhere back at home, waiting to hear from a daughter's son. We gotta get those soldiers out, they gotta know we tried. We can't leave them there to die. We gotta try. As we flew away to safety, no soldier left behind. With the fire gun raining down on us, we made it out in time. We gotta get those soldiers out, they gotta know we tried. We can't leave them there to die. We gotta try.
May 15th, 1967, started as a hot Monday morning. Soldiers from the 101st Airborne were battling hundreds of heavily armed North Vietnamese in a rural river.
Welcome back to our second half of our special program dedicated to the memory of Lieutenant Colonel Charles Kettles, Medal of Honor recipient. In this interview that we did back in 2016, this was just after he received his Medal of Honor, and we're also going to be talking with another pilot from that mission from May of 1967, and that is Colonel Donald Long. His aircraft was shot down on that day. So sit back again and relax and enjoy more stories from Colonel Charles Kettles, all about his Medal of Honor.
There's anybody here today who doesn't thrill to the sound of those blades. That familiar wop 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 is the soundtrack of our war, the lullaby of our younger days. To someone who spent his time in Nam with the grunts, I've got to tell you that noise was always a great comfort. It meant someone was coming to help. Someone was coming to get our wounded. Someone was coming to bring us water and ammo. Someone was coming to take our dead brothers home. And eventually, someone was coming to give us a ride out of hell. Even today, when I hear it, I stop, catch my breath, and think back to those days. I love you guys as only an infantryman can. No matter how bad things were, if we called, you came. Down through the green tracers and other visible signs of a real bad day, off to a real bad start. To us, you seemed beyond brave and fearless, that you would come to us in the middle of battle, in those flimsy, thin-skinned crates, and in the storm of fire, you would sit up there behind that thin plexiglass, seeming so patient and so calm and so vulnerable, waiting for the offloading and the onloading. We thought you were God's own lunatics, and we loved you. Still do. We're the fortunate ones. We survived when so many better men gave up their precious lives for us. We owe them a sacred debt to live each day to its fullest. What they're saying when you listen hard enough is this: we're at peace, and so should you be. And so should you be.
A sound never to be forgotten for anybody that was in Vietnam or anybody who's heard about Vietnam. That was Joe Galloway, who was there in 1965, actually, and is part of the book. We Were Soldiers Once and Young. Joining me in the studio right now is a special pilot, a special God's own lunatic, and that is Colonel Charles Kettles. And I'm just going to call him Sir or Colonel. Welcome back to Veterans Radio.
Well, thank you.
And joining me on the line is another colonel, is Colonel Donald Long. And Colonel, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
Thank you for agreeing to be with us. And you, Colonel Long is down in North Carolina, and there have been a little over 3,400 Medal of Honor recipients or medals that have been distributed. And we are very fortunate today to have Colonel Kettles with us. It's kind of an interesting story, I think, and some of our audience has probably heard some of it before because we've had the privilege of having you on the program. But tell me, when exactly did you join the military first time?
Well, I was drafted in October of 51 for the Korean War. I'd been attending what was then Michigan State Normal College and dropped out in the fall, was going to start again in January. I was working two full-time jobs to accumulate enough funds that I could go back more like a gentleman, and maybe my academic record would be a little bit more favorable.
That's stellar, right?
Yes, so it was less than sterling by a long shot, as the dean of men would attest to.
I think some of us have had that experience before also.
I see. Well, yeah, I don't think I'm the Lone Ranger in that respect.
No. But so you went into the service in 1951, did you say?
Correct.
And did you go to Korea?
Well, eventually. But first, of course, went to basic training in Camp Breckinridge, Kentucky. From there, I went to Fort Knox, Kentucky for Officer Candidate School. And went to Fort Ord briefly, California, and then went to flight school. And completed that in April of 54.
And when you went to flight school, what was it that you learned to fly in 1954?
The L-19, which was later designated O-1. And it's a tandem Cessna product.
Okay, I'm going to say that's a regular airplane. This is not a helicopter.
Yeah. Yes.
Not yet.
Yeah, the wings stay rigid, hopefully. And by the time I got to Korea, the war had been over by some 5 months, I believe.
All right, so there was kind of a break in the action here, too. So, I mean, you were in the military for how many years before you got out and then went back in again?
Well, I completed my obligation in the fall of 56, and nothing was happening, so I elected to get out and did so. And then my brother and I opened a Ford dealership in DeWitt, Michigan.
Oh, okay.
And then... Of course, Vietnam came along, and so I volunteered to come back on active duty in 63 for Vietnam.
Okay, and then that's when you went to rotary flight school?
Well, I cross-trained into rotary at Fort Walters, and en route to France, which was a bit of a surprise.
France? You got to go to France?
Well, it wasn't tough, but...
That
was the direction they were sending me, which okay. Didn't seem to be in the direction of Vietnam by any means. But anyway, that's where they sent me. And then I cross-trained. While there, I cross-trained over in Germany into the UH-1 helicopter, because Fort Walters was simply a primary,
right,
and transitioned into a H-23 at that time.
That's what I That's what I learned on, was the OH-23,
yeah.
Hiller.
Yes.
Right. Hold that thought. Colonel Long, I want to bring you on now and find out how you got into the military. So what was your process?
Well, it's similar in some ways. I had gone to college for 2 years, and again, money was a situation, and I dropped out to work. And I happened to be good friends with the president of the draft board in my hometown, and he wanted to hire me to do something, and I said, I want to go back to college. He said, well, I have to warn you, within 6 months you'll be drafted if you don't. So I enlisted in the Army.
Oh, okay.
In 1960. And then I, like Chuck, I went on to OCS and infantry school, and believe it or not, went to Fort Ord, and then from Fort Ord back to Fort Rucker for flight training. Again, in a bird dog, just like him.
Okay, and when did you do your rotary flight training?
Well, my first assignment out of flight school was to Germany, and I guess he and I were in Europe about the same time. I got all of my helicopter training in Munich, Germany. They set up a special school because they were draining the helicopter pilots out of Germany to go to Vietnam, and there weren't a lot of them left, so they wanted to train us fixed-wing guys to fly them.
Oh, okay.
I graduated there in May of 66, probably August of 66.
August of 66. Colonel Kettles, when did you go to Vietnam, or when did you arrive in Vietnam the first time?
In February of 67.
February. And Colonel Long?
He was with
Same thing. We were in a unit at Fort Benning that formed up to go over there as a unit, and we all went at the same time.
Okay. Colonel Kettles, were you the CO of your unit, the 176?
No. We had a Lieutenant Colonel McDaniels, who was the CO, and we had some 13 majors in the unit.
Wow.
They had all come out of the woodwork. So and I had initially the first platoon of the 176th.
Right.
However, I was the junior major out of the 13. So when Don Phillips came in, he was the ranking major, and he took over the platoon, the first platoon. And I had the option by Colonel Daniels to either stay in the platoon or else go elsewhere within the unit. I elected to stay with the first platoon, and we did very well together with Major Phillips. Then about 30, 45 days into Vietnam, Colonel McDaniels departed on emergency leave, and Phillips, who was a senior major, took over the unit, and
that's a lot of real live officers all in one place.
Well,
sounds
yes,
like.
But I was still junior major among the mm-hmm. 13, and he offered the platoon to each of the others who were senior to me, and I guess none of them wanted it. He then offered it to me, and I signed with both hands.
Understandable, yeah. Understandable. Colonel Long, what was your job? How did you fit into this scenario?
Okay, well, each platoon had two sections. I was a section leader of the first section when Chuck was a platoon leader.
Okay, so what was your call sign?
Minuteman 16 Alpha.
16 Alpha, okay.
Yeah, but within the unit, they had a nickname for people. Mine was Thin Man.
Okay, I can't tell you what mine was, at least not on the air.
Okay.
And so you're 1-6. Six usually means a leader of some sort, either
well,
squad leader.
Well, 1 was first platoon, and 6 was section leader. A was the first section.
Okay, and so you were 1-6 of the other one?
Yeah.
Yeah, 1-6 Alpha.
Okay, I got it.
Best my memory could tell me. That's been a long time.
I know, I'm really testing you guys today. I apologize for that.
That is a test.
Yeah.
All right, so you've been in country now. You got into country in February, you said, of 1967. Let's set up the day, and then we'll take our break and come back and talk about what happened on May 15th of 1967. So what was your mission on that, Colonel Keller? What was your mission on that day?
Which, 15 May?
Yeah, the first, when you were, it says that personnel, the 101st, were getting overrun, and you guys were going out to resupply them, right?
Well, if we're speaking of 15 May of 67, they simply initiated an assault into that LZ that day, so there was no one out there initially.
Right.
And we put in about 80 troops with 8 helicopters with 2 lifts initially, about 09:30 on the 15th of May. About 3 hours later, we inserted another 80, right, and withdrew the wounded. And
all right, so you, there was nobody. This was just an initial insertion initially.
Yeah.
To take, you know, this is a company size that you're putting in there, right?
Well, they had moved around into the ambush position from a relatively secure area, and so when they got ambushed, they were up against what was believed to be a battalion-sized North Vietnamese Army
so
it unit.
Looks like the tables were kind of turned on the ambush.
Well, the ambush is never good, but...
No. I want to bring Colonel Long on for just a second here. So on this first lift that went in, and you had to go back, what happened to your aircraft?
Well, I was with Chuck on the first insertion where we had, I think 8 helicopters. Is that correct, Chuck?
That's correct.
There, and all the heck broke loose, and tracers and mortars and everything else. And the thing is, we were offloading 5 or 6 people, and we're onloading 2 to 3 or 4 wounded. So It was a matter of dropping off the good guys and picking the wounded up and taking them back. And I had taken mine back to offload the wounded. In the meantime, I believe Chuck had gone back in again. And on my way back, he advised me to get a hold of another helicopter to take some ammo in and some other troops. And on my second trip in, we exposed ourselves too long. The fire was heavy, and the second ship with us managed to get out. But we were left alone, so we hovered over to get wounded because they wouldn't bring them out of the trees. And by doing that, they focused all of their fire on us and just blew us up in the LZ, so we became infantrymen. That was Mr. Roy, Ron Roy, Spec 4 Holly, and PFC Washington were the crew. By the way, one officer Roy retired as lieutenant colonel also. So. Anyway, we were left there to fight until Chuck came back to get us all.
All right, so you're on the ground in this LZ, and in reading the details of the operation, we know that there were jets that came in and dropped their loads. You had gunships and everything else. And then, Colonel Kettles, how many times did you go in and out of this LZ?
A total of six times.
Wow. Six times, and you're still here.
Pardon me?
And you're still here. That's what's surprising, because it sounded like it was, you mentioned how many bad guys were down there. Were they NVAs?
Yes.
All right.
Yes. Well, they were serious.
I understand that. So you went in there six times. You got Colonel Long is on the ground, with his crew. So I'm sure, I know that would have to be a big concern to you as well. In many of these return flights that you're bringing people in, taking people out, you lost a few aircraft yourself.
Well, over the course of the entire mission that day, we went through some 19. And the one that Don Long flew on that resupply mission was destroyed entirely in the LZ. And each of the other 18, of course, were of varying degrees of damage. None, of course, were flyable, but in the two that I had flown, both of those got evac'd with a CH-47 down to Vung Tau and the Corpus mm-hmm. Christi because they were damaged beyond
You broke them.
Well, yes.
They were
well,
broken.
As a matter of fact, the Secretary of the Army presented me with an invoice at the ceremony for the 19 helicopters. Now, it's only a cost of $89,300,000.
Okay.
But
and this
he
has
said
to be
it
paid.
Was it's payable with a credit card. However, my credit card company has a different idea. The credit limit is not going to even come close. So,
I think Doug's too modest to tell you that both of his helicopters were just laced to pieces with 30 to 40 holes in them, in plexiglass and everything. They were really messed up.
I know. You're on the ground. Colonel Long, you're on the ground, and you're watching Colonel Kettles come in more than once with his entire team. And let's face it, Colonel Kettles wasn't the only pilot out there that day. And the only aircraft. I mean, there were other 18 crews that were going in and out of there on a fairly regular basis until they kept, you know. I'm talking in aviation terminology here that we broke the aircraft, and so we had to go get new ones. Yeah. And you were able to borrow a couple or some from another sister company, right?
Well, when it came to the emergency extraction for the last 44, which included the four of Don's crew, we, in the 176th, only had one flyable UH-1D lift-type helicopter. So we had to borrow five with crews from the sister company, the 161st, up the street. And I say up the street, probably 30 miles up,
right.
up the road. And then we simply rendezvoused in the air in close proximity to the LZ before going in. They were coming out from the north, and we were coming out from Duck Fold. And so then we, of course, went in trail formation because of the LZ configuration and picked up what we thought were the entire 44, which included Don Long and his mm-hmm. group, when the trail aircraft commander announced that they were all on board. We departed the LZ, climbed to about 1,200 feet, and then started a left turn about 180 degrees back toward Duck Fold. When the command and control aircraft, someone on board that, told me that there were eight infantry troops down there who did not get on board any one of the helicopters.
Well, any particular reason? Were they pinned down or
well, they had been down in the riverbed below putting up a last-ditch effort to defense against the North Vietnamese Army while the troops loaded. And they had simply not gotten up in time to get on board the helicopters. And, of course, the aircraft commander on that last one, he had no idea they were there.
Yeah, I don't think anybody sometimes can realize the confusion of what goes on the ground when you're trying to get everybody on board an aircraft and trying to make sure that you have enough power to get off, you know, actually get off the ground sometimes up there. So you already had some troops on board yours?
I only had one on board. I had no idea what the distribution was behind me in the mm-hmm. balance of the five helicopters, but I had only the one. And so I simply turned the flight over to number two for him to take them back to Duck Pho and the medical facilities that were co-located there.
Okay.
And I simply broke off when I got back a beam, the troops, and I could see them. I was in the left seat. They were to my left. Sechrist, who was my co-pilot, was in the right. And, of course, he couldn't see them, but I could.
Mm-hmm.
So I simply took the controls and broke off from the flight and went in back into the LZ again.
You had no guns at this point? I mean, you had the guns on the helicopter, but you didn't have any gunship supported?
On the gunships and the fast movers, Air Force that is, with napalm and such, had departed along with, and the artillery had shut down because they were of the opinion
that everybody was
that
out.
The LZ was clean.
Oh,
so with only, by I guess, the element of surprise, I went back in to pick up the eight.
I'm sorry. I'm kind of breathless here as I'm listening to this story. Colonel Long, were you able to get out on that lift that went out?
I was able to get out on the first one. I got wounded in my leg, and I couldn't walk. So I had two of the infantrymen got on each side of me and helped me across the LZ. I had told them too many people try to get on the closest helicopters.
Mm-hmm.
So we're going to the farthest helicopter. So that's what they did. I carried the radio for them, and they dragged me and got me on a helicopter. So I was part of the initial group, not the final eight.
Okay. All right. So what? Just quickly, tell me what your feelings were when you took off out of that LZ.
Go to me?
Yes, sir.
Oh, relief. Great relief and whole bunch of thanks, because as you may have surmised by now, that myself and 43 others probably wouldn't be here if it hadn't been for him.
Well, yes. Yes.
And I had five children married at the time, as did he.
It continues to be an amazing story. We're talking here with America's newest Medal of Honor recipient, Colonel Charles Kettles, and also Colonel Donald Long. Both of these people were very busy on that May Day of 1967. When they had gone into a landing zone initially to drop off troops for a mission, and they ended up, the troops on the ground ended up being ambushed, and then they had to go back and get them, and that's where we are in our story right now. So Colonel Kettles does a reverse and goes back into this LZ, and I'm sure that even the bad guys on the ground are going, what the heck is going on here? What is this person doing? And I'm sure they unloaded on your aircraft.
Well, yes. Then, of course, they had one single target.
Yes.
Which was, I guess, to their advantage. And almost immediately after touchdown, why, a mortar round went off the nose of the helicopter, and which took out the left chin bubble where I was, and the part of each of the windshields, and the rest of the damage I didn't shut down and do a pre-flight.
You didn't do an inspection at the time.
No, I still had a clean panel.
Mm-hmm.
And the troops, of course, loaded with great haste. And
when the crew chief said they're all on board, why, and I had turned over the controls back over to Ray Sechrist in the right and gave him a thumbs up and let's go. And he picked it up, and it began to fishtail back and forth for whatever reason. I don't know. Doesn't make much difference. But anyway, in the process, I learned later, one of the grunts got thrown out the left side when it fishtailed like that. And he grabbed the skid on the way out, and his buddies were able to pull him back in again. And then I took control of the helicopter, and being overweight by probably 600-700 pounds.
Right.
The Dash 11 engine was not up to it, so rotor RPM dissipated slowly, and the warning horn, of course, came on. So simply lowered the collective, which offloads the blade, regained the RPM again, then traded that RPM for forward speed, because what I needed was about 35, 40 knots to get in and get the machine into translational lift, and if it was going to go, why it would go at that point. If not, why we were going to be a 2.5-ton truck going down the road with a rotor head, I guess.
That's you're just riding on down the road. Forget about this getting up into the air. That's for people that are not in aviation. That's a difficult thing to do. Is kind of I'm using my hands here, and I know, you're playing with the controls in order to get the blade to turn fast enough so that you can get it any lift at all and continue moving forward. And you got to remember, he doesn't have any chin bubble. He doesn't have any windshield. I'm sure that all the needles are going back and forth all over the place as he's trying to nurse this thing and actually pull it into the air. As we say, pull pitch, just go and hope that you can get up there. And you probably bounced a few times before you finally got off.
It took about five or six of the treating the rotor RPM for forward speed, mm-hmm. then treating that for for rotor RPM and back and forth about five or six times down that river valley before it actually took off.
So you're up and you're out of there.
Yes.
How did that feel, as he said, relief?
It seemed like a damn good idea to me.
So how far did you have to take these people that were on board your aircraft while everything is, wind is blowing in your hair, as they say?
Well, it was quite well air-conditioned at that point, with a ventilation through there, so it was more comfortable, I guess, that way.
Humble is not the word I can use right now. Right now. So you had to fly them back to, where did you take the troops
back? To Duck Fall and the facilities that were there, co-located medical.
What's really amazing about this story, folks, is how many people were wounded from your unit or the unit of all the aviation units, how many were wounded?
I think there were a total of nine, Don Long being one, Roland Scheck, who was my gunner up until the last, up until the point we did the emergency extraction, he had taken a 51 in the knee, which destroyed his leg and the upper part of the leg as well. So it was later amputated at Quinon in the day. And he also took a round in the chest protector.
And Colonel Long, what happened to you? Where did you go?
You mean after I was...
After you were extracted and evacuated, where did you end up?
Well, they took me to the 1st Brigade, 101st Medical Tent, because I had shrapnel through my leg. But and they repaired it and had a toe tag on me to send me on to Quinon. But they got the word that Quinon was getting full, the hospital, because it wasn't just 101st having problems that day. I suppose others were, too. So they told me to stay in the area and get daily treatments at the medical tent. I was able to... to walk with a cane.
I'm sorry, we run out of time. Hopefully I can get you two men back on the program again some other day, and we can go into...
Say thanks to Chuck again one more time.
You got it, Colonel Long. Thank you very much also for being out there in North Carolina. Colonel Kells, thank you very much. You are dismissed.